There's a time and a place for filet of fish. But breakfast is for sausage biscuits. McDonald's breakfast comes first. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World. Anna Borshevskaya is the author of the new book, Putin's War in Syria, Russian Foreign Policy and the Price of America's Absence. Russia is now engaged in, after 2013, the fall of 2013, in Syria. However, Anna presents the three ways of Russian engagement that are quite distinct from how the Soviet Union handled Afghanistan, even how Yeltsin's government handled the first and second Chechen wars. The three phases we'll do as best we can, given Anna's deep reporting here: military, domestic, and diplomatic. Military. Anna, right away, you make the point that the Kremlin's commitment in Syria is to keep Assad in power. Everything is focused on that. Everything domestic reporting, everything diplomatic conversation, to keep him in power. What did Mr. Putin and his counselors take from Afghanistan and Chechnya that they immediately applied to their Syrian intervention?
The first lesson of Afghanistan is that the Soviet Union relied largely on ground troops. It was a major conventional troop presence. And if you look at how Russia handled itself in Syria, they couldn't get away with zero boots on the ground, but really this was a primarily heavily aerial campaign with a naval component. And this put Russian officers at much lower risk, so the lower risk in terms of getting hurt or killed. These were also clearly special elite forces rather than simply conscripts. In other words, special forces had gone into Syria rather than conscripts that were had no choice but to go into Afghanistan with no training or, frankly, desire to be there. Another is an invitation from Assad. The Soviet Union, the fact of the matter is, look, they had engineered an invasion. They had for years tried to conjure up a piece of paper that said that they were invited into Afghanistan. But the fact of the matter is, in Syria, they really did have an invitation to point to. This was not made up. So this was a much more surgically well-crafted intervention, and it was designed to keep casualties low and expenditures low as well, because it also relied on other actors, chiefly Iran and Iranian proxies, to do the heavy lifting.
The light footprint, that's what they learned in Afghanistan and Chechnya. Domestically, yes. They also learned, Mr. Putin and his counselors learned, that you must keep the Russian public informed. But how informed? Anna, I discovered through you that there was a song as early as the early part of this decade, this century. Syria, my sister, our Russian brothers, we will save you. Spectacular piece of propaganda. However, at the same time, the news is completely controlled in Russia, and they learned how to tell stories. What is Ruski Mir? What does that mean, and how is that important for the way they tell stories?
Ruski Mir is it's a Russian state, basically a foundation with the idea that a foundation created by the Russian government with the idea of spreading sort of basically Kremlin propaganda that Russia is a special civilization. It sort of has a special mission in terms of how it presents Russia to the world through cultural centers in different countries and so forth. It is also, I should say, not the only arm of Russian propaganda. Ruski Mir is more externally focused. That's within Russia. There are other propaganda outlets. But it's a certain kind of you can call it a soft power tool, sort of with an authoritarian bent, if you will, depending on how we look at the definition of the term soft power, that presents a very particular version of Russia to the world through the cultural engagement.
I note one particular incident of how the Kremlin has shaped the story told to the Russian people. 12/26/16, almost exactly. 12/26/16, the day after Western Christmas, the Red Army Choir loses 64 members in a flight over the Black Sea, a crash of an airplane. and Mr. Putin declares a day of mourning. What did that achieve? What was he thinking of when the Kremlin did that, Anna?
Well, it's bringing back this particular instance, it's bringing back not only historical memories, but also playing on feelings of patriotism, emotion, which, again, in Russia, given its history, heavy losses that Russia historically suffered in previous wars, it kind of holds a special emotional component, if you will. You know, the key thing about how the Kremlin presented the Syria campaign to the Russian public is that it tried to show that the costs in terms of blood and treasure to the Russian people were ultimately low. And frankly, Syria had long since disappeared from Russian news as a priority, the way it was early on in the intervention. Which shows you how careful the Kremlin was in understanding that the Russian public was become much more casualty averse than it used to be in the past.
Why is polling important to Mr. Putin? He polls very well compared to other presidents.
There's an inherent, first, it's an inherent sort of insecurity, lack of trust in his own pollsters, perhaps. But the fact of the matter is Putin very much cares about his public opinion. And perhaps because he knows that so much of the public opinion is engineered, there's less trust in positive numbers. It's almost like a lack of kind of self-confidence that you need constant reassurance. But the fact of the matter is, it's a little bit, you know, one might think if you're dealing with an authoritarian country, then the leader doesn't care about what the public thinks. But that's not the case, certainly not in Russia. He very much cares about public opinion, and that's why he works so hard to manipulate it.
Diplomatic. This is the three ways that Russia is dealing with Syria, distinct from Afghanistan and Chechnya catastrophes. Military, domestic, presenting to the American, to the Russian people. And now diplomatic, working with all the countries in the region. That word colleague, that word partner, it's commonplace with Mr. Putin. Is it successful to refer to obvious adversaries as a partner?
Well, the fact of the matter is the key difference from how Putin is approaching the Middle East as compared to how the Soviet Union approached the Middle East is precisely from this idea that Russia needs to work with all major actors on the ground. Including very conflicting actors. And thus Russia has good relations with Iran and Hezbollah and also the State of Israel, for example, and Turkey. So really the play here was precisely to balance good relations between everybody and position Russia as a mediator. In fact, Russia did the same thing even in Syria, between, for example, the SDF, Syrian Democratic Forces, and the Assad regime, and so forth. If we think back again to the Red Line incident, again, Russia offered a diplomatic solution. So rather than this kind of Cold War confrontation that we remember during the Cold War, instead, many had come to perceive Russia as part of a solution. And herein, again, lies the key difference and success in terms of what Putin has been able to achieve.
And achieve it by looking as a peacemaker. I understand that. I take from your presentation that the Kremlin means to stay in Syria forever, indefinitely, never leave right now. And in order to understand, this is not an intervention that has a time date. They're not talking about when are we leaving the Middle East. We're talking about a Kremlin that is extremely confident that it has knitted itself into Syrian life. It's gained physical things, three or four bases, naval bases, air bases, military bases. It's gained physical things as well in arms sales and loans. But we're going to turn to lessons learned in the Kremlin through these years and lessons learned in Washington as well, especially if you read Anna's new book, Putin's War in Syria, Russian Foreign Policy and the Price of America's Absence. Anna Borchevskaya of the Washington Institute. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 million protection package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.